Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Donald Trump can't make his bond, and Bernie Sanders wants us all to work less. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined, as always, by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brenda Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National U podcast. Our sponsor of this episode is Fast Growing Trees. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, Trump has said he can't pay up. He's had he has a filing appealing this so-called disgorgement, which is $450 million and counting, which is a lot, especially if you've exaggerated your wealth and a lot of your wealth is caught up in real estate that can't be made liquid very easily, to say the least. And this, the clock is ticking. If he doesn't get relief on this and doesn't post it, you know, he needs a miracle sale of Truth Social or something to actually have enough to post it. Beginning Monday, Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, can begin literally going after his assets and after his buildings. She has repeatedly says, I look at 40 Wall Street every day.
Yeah, well, it shows how nuts lawfare can get in this campaign season. Obviously, I think that the basis of this nearly $500 million fine is an insanity. A tort should be about a real civil harm done to a real victim, not a notional one done to the state's accounting record. When there's no losses inflicted on anyone. But this is going to do nothing but inflame Trump supporters. It inflames me, and I'm not a particularly big fan of Trump, but the injustice is so obvious. And, you know, it also will be a treacherous thing. I mean, not all the buildings that Trump owns, he owns outright. So the idea of seizing 30% of a building as a share and then selling it or auctioning it by the state as a kind of political war trophy, I think it just brings great shame onto Letitia James, and it is probably dangerous for the country.
Yeah, Maddie, this, first of all, I should say, I said Letitia James repeatedly said she looks at 40 Wall Street. That I'm aware of, she only said that once, but she says she looks at it every day. She's also talked about being willing to seize Trump Tower, and she's also repeatedly posted on Twitter the amount of this disgorgement, which is going up every day by more than $100,000. So she's clearly spiking the football. And, you know, from her perspective, justifiably so. You look at Georgia, Fani Willis has disgraced herself. She's hanging on by her fingernails. In that case, Jack Smith, who's so desperate to get off the ground before the election day, may not do it with either his cases, the J6 case or the classified documents case down in Florida. And then you have Alvin Bragg, who's stuck with this dog of a Stormy Daniels case that may very well happen, but is not going to move numbers against Donald Trump. But here is Letitia James, who picked up this case that the SDNY passed on, that Alvin Bragg passed on, that Alvin Bragg's predecessor passed on, where there's no harm, involves sophisticated financial players, representatives of which testified at this trial that, of course, we didn't just rely on Trump's representation. We'd never do that. We're not idiots. We base our lending decisions on our own evaluation, and there's no harm. None of them said, oh, we lost money or we didn't get the loan back. So this case is a real stretch, but kind of brings out my inner Randian because of that. I mean, to MBD's point, Trump, whatever you think of him, and he's not a highly ethical guy, lots of sharp business practices, and he did totally distort the reports of the value of this various properties. But he changed the skyline of New York and built real things. And here comes the government on the flimsiest of grounds and potentially could be able to scoop up these properties, just take them from him.
Yeah, the optics, I think, help Trump politically, even though it obviously comes at huge legal and financial cost to him. You're quite right. There was no fraud victims in what he did. There were no financial harms to the state that have been proven. And so the penalty is so excessive and so over the top that I think there's a good argument that it violates the Eighth Amendment's guarantee against excessive fines. I mean, Trump really doesn't have a huge amount of options here. One thing he could do, of course, is declare bankruptcy. But I think, and this is something he's obviously faced before in a different context with corporate bankruptcies, which he's been able to sort of dismiss as, oh, well, that was just investors, and he'd never had to file personally. But I don't think he's going to do that in this case. I think the scene of Letitia James and the sheriff showing up to 40 Wall Street and making this huge scene is probably just proof to the point that he's being attacked for partisan reasons. Letitia James has already made that clear, like even in her campaign, that this was a big priority for her, was going after Trump for blatantly partisan reasons. And I think that does just prove the case and certainly help Trump's case that he's a victim in all this.
Yeah, Charlie, it strikes me if you're going to bring this case against Trump, and he did exaggerate the numbers. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It's the kind of thing where you find him guilty and you fine him a dollar. But instead, they found him guilty and have imposed this potentially ruinous penalty that has no connection to any real harm that happened.
I am not obviously a lawyer, and specifically I'm not a lawyer in this area, but the facts of this case get my hackles up. If you describe this to somebody without mentioning Donald Trump, it would sound off, wouldn't it? If you said the Attorney General of a state promised to go after a major political figure of the opposing party, then did it in a way that is not usually done to other people, did it in a way that resulted in an extraordinarily large judgment, and then the judge in the case made it effectively impossible for the defendant to raise the money to pay for it. And that, incidentally, is one of the flaws with having New York at the center of the banking system. If New York acts as a state and says you can't raise money from banks that are chartered in or connected to New York, and every single bank that is likely to lend someone money is located there, you've essentially cut them out of capital. And if they don't provide the money, then you can fine them, take their stuff, or add enormous amounts of interest, hundreds of thousands of dollars of interest a week. I think most people would say, you know, isn't that an Eighth Amendment violation? Now, it's not, for various technical reasons, but it sounds off to me. It seems wrong. And I think it seems wrong independently, as you say, Rich, of whether or not Trump has any culpability here, which he clearly does. In our system, And again, I understand this is a complex area and there are nuances that I don't comprehend. But in our system, we do distinguish between is X a bad person and did X do some things wrong and can Y do whatever she wants to X? And we don't have carte blanche. We don't say this person is a witch, therefore. I just think this is illiberal. Now, perhaps I have a problem with the system per se. Perhaps I'll get emails saying you don't fully appreciate the extent to which this is how this works. Well, then I have a problem with the system per se. Or perhaps this is singling out one person, potentially on political grounds. But this story bothers me. As someone who is more open than most at National Review to the idea that Trump has brought most of his legal troubles on himself, this bothers me. I feel like there is a catch-22 here. I feel like there is a slightly frivolous prosecution followed by an egregious punishment that has been adorned by rules that are designed to make it very difficult for the punished to proceed, that make appealing expensive in a way that it shouldn't be, and that are likely to turn those of us who are either critical of Trump or neutral towards Trump into sympathizers in this particular realm.
So MBD, another case, new event this week. George Stephanopoulos, a weekend or two ago, had this instantly notorious interview with Nancy Mace, congresswoman from South Carolina, where he said, "You're a victim of rape, and here you are supporting a man who's been found guilty of rape. How can that be so?" They went back and forth in a really emotional exchange. And she said at one point, "You know, by the way, George, he wasn't found guilty of rape." And then George is like, "Ah, you know, I knew you were going to say that. Here's a headline with a judge says, no, you can't say that he wasn't found guilty of rape." And technically, he was not found guilty of rape, but the act he was found guilty of is rape in other jurisdictions, which the judge said. But Trump has sued George Stephanopoulos for libel. What do you make of it?
I mean, well, there's a couple of things. One, I absolutely, there's a kind of karmic satisfaction that I have to mention first in watching George Stephanopoulos get sued over something like this, or for him to take the high road on matters of sexual assault allegations at all. I mean, this guy's career as a frontman for Bill Clinton at Bill Clinton's horn doggiest is revolting. And like, so, a pox on all their houses. I mean, Donald Trump is perfectly within his rights to try to vindicate his reputation from public smears and slanders and being called a rapist if you, you know, if you are not one or if you've not been proven one. I mean, this is something that people try to test in the courts. And if you have the resources and the lawyers to contest it, I mean, Trump has legal resources that seem pretty well tied up right now, but you know, you try to lash back because otherwise it's open season on you. I don't think this is going to go anywhere in the long term, but as like as a moral dispute and as a moral matter, you know, I can't say George doesn't deserve it. Segment was awful, and you know, ABC's lawyers, I'm sure, will be thrilled to have the extra hours to bill, and you know, they'll take it from there. But this is mudslinging at its lowest, and it's going to be throughout the rest of the campaign. I mean, Trump's not above it either. I mean, Trump, when he was running against Hillary Clinton, he was bringing up Bill Clinton's sexual sins and trying to make them a major feature of news reporting in the race in 2016. So
Maddie, what was your, outside of the legal question here, what did you make of this line of inquiry? So May said, you're shaming me, you're rape shaming me. And I didn't get that exactly, but there's no doubt that Stephanopoulos probably wouldn't have asked this question, certainly wouldn't have ended up devoting the entirety of this segment to it, or almost the entirety segment to it, if it had been a Democrat. But is this a legitimate question to ask a Nancy Mace?
So he was basically asking her, how is this consistent with your support for how is your own experience consistent with your support for and he said, you know, somebody found liable of rape. And I just think it's such a personal place to go, you know, to sort of bring up somebody's history of sexual abuse and sort of try and make a political point with it. And especially you kind of have to go into the legal context here. The E. Jean Carroll case was not criminal. It was really not particularly convincing on the facts. And yes, I understand that there's a point about, oh, well, rape and sexual abuse, they're sort of a distinction without a difference. That might be true in the law. That might be true that, there, you know, what counts as rape in one jurisdiction is different. And I'm conscious, you know, people might be listening to this in the car with children around, so I'm not going to go into exactly what the difference is. But I do think that there is a moral difference between these things, and that we should take them seriously. And the accusation of rape is a very, very serious one. And to Michael's point, if somebody accused of it, and if they've been wrongly accused of it, is going to want to do everything in their power to clear their name. I do think, though, that this probably wasn't a smart move of Trump's. It's just not a good look for a former president, potentially a future president, to be going after a journalist. It's also just, I don't think he can win this. There was a similar dispute with Judge Kaplan when Trump countersued Carroll for saying that he'd raped her, and Kaplan found that Carroll's assertion was substantially true, again going back to that distinction without a difference point, and that no legal harm was done to him. So I don't see that he's going to win this. But I do also understand that if you haven't done something and you're accused of it, then you're going to be morally indignant and want to clear your name.
Charlie?
Well, I'm bothered by the potential double standard here. Do you remember 10 years ago, David Gregory held up the magazine from an AR-15?
Yep, so illegal in Washington.
Right. And the argument that he made when people pointed this out was, that was it. Well, it's not ha for the lots of people who have been prosecuted in Washington, D.C. for possession, often the inadvertent possession, of firearms or firearms parts. People have flown in from other states and they didn't realize they had a sort of ammunition in their bag that they got caught with at the airport and went to jail for. If we are going to have, and we should have, a really robust system of free speech in this country that extends into the civil realm, that protects people against endless libel suits, then we need to have that consistently. Fox News was hit with an enormous, enormous fine for comments that certain members of its staff made about Dominion. And the argument that was made was, well, they're a news organization. Their hosts are briefed. Some of what they say is put into the teleprompter. And they went out there and they said things that weren't true and they damaged the reputation. I was skeptical of this. I remain skeptical of it. But if that's the standard, why is George Stephanopoulos exempt? He is not a stupid man. He's not a man who doesn't know the difference between civil and criminal trials. He's not a man who is unable to read through legal documents or who doesn't have people around him who can read through legal documents. I doubt that show was produced without a meeting or a brief or writers. I don't want Trump to prevail here. Trump has his own terrible views on the question of libel. But I do want us to treat news organizations that say things that aren't true in the same way, not depending on whether or not they're on the good side or the bad side, or the people that they're allegedly libeling are sympathetic or not. And I'm a little bit nervous as to where this is going. I'm a little bit nervous that there is a sense among left-wing outlets that they can just advance the David Gregory defense, which was, which is not how our system is supposed to work.
So, MED, exit question to you. If Letitia James hypothetically seizes Trump Tower, this will, in political terms, help Trump or hurt Trump or have no effect?
In political terms, it will help him. But I mean, the cost psychologically is just massive. I can't imagine it's a price he really wants to pay.
Yeah, there was a New York Post story speculating yesterday that Trump just might let her have it, you know, just take Trump Tower. There's no way, right? I mean, you'd have to get that thing out of his cold, dead fingers. Maddie Kearns, that would help or hurt Trump politically?
I mean, it does help him politically, but it hurts him so seriously in other ways that I'm not sure it's worth it.
Charlie?
Once again, distinguishing between what the law demands and politics, I do not think the Democrats want that visual. It just looks so punitive. I just think it will be spun so effectively. Look at the state of New York taking his skyscraper building because they hate him. It says Trump on it. And they have to go in front of all of the cameras and possess it. I just think that is, if Letitia James thinks she wants that politically, she's wrong.
Yeah, I think she'd be an idiot to do it. Maybe the fervor is such that she will do it and she'll get applauded by the people she cares about most, her progressive base. But I agree, this would be completely a bridge too far. And as I've said before, you know, I think people accused and investigated of things in the political realm, the assumption is that they're guilty and the investigation is political. These, you know, we talked about this earlier in the week, these things are kind of equally balanced in the case of Trump right now. But I think this would really tip it over to this is political zealotry. This is a step too far. So if she's going to start collecting on him soon, she should, for the good of her own side, should forbear and find a less spectacular way to do it. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor this episode, actually our only sponsor this episode, Fast Growing Trees. Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the U.S.? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 or 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever. Our first fast-growing tree here in the Lowry household, in fact, a lavender bush, just arrived here. It's really amazing. You just go to the website, literally a couple clicks, and before you know it, literally a tree, a real living tree, or in this case, a lavender bush, shows up at your front door. Now I have to go out and plant this thing after my wife, of course, tells me where exactly to put it. And I didn't have to drive around to nurseries or big gardening centers. Not my favorite thing to do, to be honest. And if I mess it up, which isn't impossible to imagine, I'll have access to the fast-growing tree experts who are available 24/7. This spring, Fast Growing Trees has the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to the editors get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code editors at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code editors at checkout. Again, fastgrowingtrees.com. Code editors. The offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply, but please check it out. So, Maddie, we have this ongoing dispute between Texas and the federal government about whether it's okay for Texas to attempt to enforce the immigration laws in the absence of such a serious effort on the part of the federal government. Texas has passed an immigration enforcement law, so-called SB 4. The Supreme Court is going to allow this to be enforced while this case works its way up inevitably to the Supreme Court. What do you make of it?
Yeah, so I think that the reactions to it have been overblown on both sides. You know, Governor Abbott was sort of saying this was a great win, as was Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. And really, it's briefly cleared the way for implementation of this law. It still has to have the hearings in the Fifth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. And so I would be wary of making too much of it, not least because Justice Barrett didn't say that SB4 is constitutional or that it should take effect, but just said that actually it should be the Fifth Circuit to be the first mover in this. Clearly, though, on a political level, so legal victories aside, clearly this does help Abbott. He's able to present himself as like the leader on the GOP and fighting back against what is basically Joe Biden's disastrous immigration policies. I mean, this has happened because Biden has let the border crisis get so out of hand. You know, Texas is effectively begging the Supreme Court to let it enforce its own law. I don't think that ultimately they have the jurisdiction to do that, but I understand why they've escalated it in the way they have. And as I say, I think it is a political win for the Texas GOP and the GOP nationwide.
So, Charlie, this is a bizarre thing, because usually you expect a state federal government dispute to be the federal government has this law and the state doesn't like it, so the state's going to defy the law. Instead, you have the federal government has these laws. The federal government doesn't like them, is not going to enforce them in effect, and the state wants to, and the federal government is saying, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, usually the state says the federal law is unconstitutional or a bad idea, or more often, that the state's not going to help. I'm in New York City right now. That is the official position of New York City, although it might be changing, that it's not going to use its staff to enforce federal immigration law or help enforce federal immigration law or cooperate with those who enforce federal immigration law. That's legal, by the way.
Right. And the courts say you can't, the federal government can't force you to use your people.
Yeah. It's Prince versus United States. You can't commandeer state officials. You have to do it yourself. That's why during Prohibition, the Treasury Department had to expand. That was less clear back then. Now it's been defined in a case, I think, from 1998, written by Justice Scalia and brought by gun rights groups. Sanctuary cities are the product of a case that was about the Brady Act, I think. Anyhow, as you say, this is extremely weird because you have the state saying, we want to faithfully execute federal law, or at least our own laws that tally with federal law. And you have the federal government saying, no, you're not allowed to. Now, we talked about this last time, and I pointed out back then what I'll point out now, which is that this is something of a gray area, not in the sense that the federal government isn't supreme when it comes to what is federal law. The Supremacy Clause clearly applies here. So if, for example, the federal government said that as of tomorrow, when I say the federal government, I mean Congress, said as of tomorrow, anyone under the age of 30 is allowed to come into the United States, presumptively, without any screening whatsoever, Texas could not then have a different law and say, no, our cutoff is 25 or 35, or we'll stop those people come in, or we'll add conditions or whatever. But what you've got here is a very weird loophole in which the federal government is saying, yes, we have laws passed by Congress, but the executive branch's interpretation of those laws, including non-enforcement or discretion in enforcement, is also to be binding on the states. That's not a scenario that we usually face. As you say, it's not a scenario the court has looked at very often. It's not a scenario that has come up very often. And so the constitutional question is an unusual one, and one that might break down in unusual ways. And I think perhaps just as important, that might play out in the future in ways that we can't quite anticipate. As I mentioned, the Supreme Court case that has been used by sanctuary cities and sanctuary states was brought by gun rights advocates.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how they imagined this was going to play out. Now, I think they were right, and I think that that decision is right. But the way that it has been employed since that time has largely had to do with immigration and not guns. Whatever the court eventually decides on the merits of this case, there's a great deal of procedural law happening, which is why it keeps bouncing around. But whatever the Supreme Court decides on the merits may in 10 or 15 years become a flashpoint in our politics in a way that we actually can't comprehend right now, and a way that will possibly be used by Republicans in a way that Democrats can't imagine now. So this is a tough one. The politics of it, I think Maddie is right, are very good for Texas, for Greg Abbott, and probably for the broader Republican Party. If you can become the symbol of defiance against the federal government on an issue where the majority of the public is with you, it is in almost every circumstance good for you and good for your party. And politically, that's what's happened to it.
Yeah, and MBD, just the administration's case against what Texas is doing, it's so absurd. I mean, it's just preposterous. You know, they're saying Texas is causing chaos, you know, in a condition of ungovernability at the border, as though we didn't have chaos before. And that's what Texas is reacting to. And it'd be one thing if the federal government was desperate to get control of the border, to turn people around and deport them immediately. And, you know, Texas was putting up barbed wire that was getting in the way of the federal agents who are trying to push the illegal immigrants back, or whatever. But that's not remotely what's happening.
Right. No. And it's, I mean, this all goes back to just the Biden administration's approach to the border, right? Which is to, you know, the laws on the books are undermined entirely by the guidance given to enforcement by the Department of HHS and, the Department of Homeland Security. And, you know, at every level, we have this kind of maladministration, right, where the Biden administration creates these little quasi-legal loopholes that encourage people to come. Then they file them through them and over them. They use NGO groups to kind of instruct the migrants and how to successfully avoid the obvious snares that our immigration law sets up to kind of capture them and find out whether they have a legal or non-legal asylum claim. And, you know, they do that. Then the Biden administration tries to, you know, spread the chaos across the rest of the country. And of course, you know, the only sensible reaction is to do what Texas has done, and is to say, no, we'll try to take, you know, the law into our own hands as much as possible and impose some kind of order, because the costs are falling on these border states too. I mean, the insane costs on hospitals, on first responders, on all sorts of civil services at the border is totally intolerable, and it's being inflicted by deliberate maladministration from the White House. So, bully for Texas, and I hope they succeed. I mean, I don't want to pronounce definitively on the legal issues for the reasons Charlie outlined.
That's what I'm going to ask everyone to do.
Ugh.
You know, it is worth saying, Michael, that while I don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do here, because our immigration law at that level has been really unusual for a long time. I mean, you have all this superintendence of it since about 2000 that is at odds with the earlier rule, which was that Congress has plenary power over immigration.
Yeah.
In the early republic, the federal government theoretically could have passed a bunch of laws, but chose not to. The states did it. They were in charge of citizenship and so on. But I think Ron DeSantis, who made a video about this recently, is right when he says that it's a matter of original understanding. If the states had believed that they were prohibited, if the federal government wished to prohibit them from enforcing their own borders, they would never have joined the union in the first place. I think that is true.
So I'll ask you the question that you've already said is very hard to answer. So is your guess that Texas prevails or no?
Well, I think it depends whether or not this case is decided on strictly originalist grounds or whether the higgledy-piggledy of immigration precedents that have been built up in different directions over the years come into play. So I don't quite know what the justices will do. I think I know how Clarence Thomas will rule. Mm-hmm.
So Maddie, your guess whether Texas will prevail or not?
I think it won't, but I confess I have a limited understanding of this. But just from my reading, I thought this was really a matter for federal law and that ultimately they get to decide it.
MBD?
I think Texas prevails, yeah.
I think Texas prevails, or at least prevails more. Yeah, the last time the Supreme Court heard this was at Arizona, a case where Arizona was trying to do this and just it totally slammed Arizona. I think wrongly and in a way that just makes zero sense to me. So I think the court will improve from there. I'm not sure Texas wins a sweeping victory, but I think it'll at least be a partial victory with that. Let me do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com, your way around our meter paywall, your way. Sign up and log in, see about 90% fewer ads, your way, if you want to comment on articles and blog posts and get invited to exclusive calls and events with National Review writers, editors, and other conservative figures. And most importantly, it's really a crucial way to support our valuable journalism. We need people to pay a little for what they read at nationalreview.com. Not a lot, but at least a little. So if you're not already a member, please consider becoming one today, tomorrow, or the day after. So Charlie, Bernie Sanders is pushing and is going to introduce, if he hasn't already, a bill to go move to a four-day work week. And Bernie asks, why isn't it time, finally, given how much more productive we are than a century ago, why isn't it time for Americans to work less and earn exactly the same? And why isn't it, Charlie? Why isn't it that time?
It was never time for that. I just hate this. I hate this in every way. I hate it in theory. I hate it in practice. I don't understand why the federal government gets any say over this as a general rule. I can see a few circumstances in which you might need regulations. If you want to, for example, determine how much certain immigrants have to make, then you have to have some math to do that. And if you're doing hourly rates, then you would have to know how many hours you're talking about. I'm not into those rules. They're driven by the unions. I think they're counterproductive. But I can see at the margins a case for the federal government determining that. The federal government's going to set rules for its own employees, certainly. And there are some jobs that are dangerous if done for too much time. Pilots, for example, should have limits imposed on their ability to fly.
Hope Sarah's listening.
But Bernie Sanders is not talking about those edge cases. Bernie Sanders is trying to change American work culture. And I simply don't believe that's the role of the federal government, or any government, for that matter. I don't know why we would define this centrally. I don't know why that would be Congress's job. I also think that it is a ridiculous thing to want to do. Work is good. Work is good for people. If anything, we should work more. We are massively in debt. We probably don't want to discourage people from working, have more people who are retired or partially retired or earning less. And of course, Bernie Sanders says, well, we wouldn't be earning less. But he seems to believe that economics is fake, that it's just completely divorced from anything real, that if you change the expectations of the work week, there will be no effect whatsoever on employers or productivity. He's jumped on the buzzwords of the era. He said, now we have AI. Now we have AI. Well, we have ChatGPT that came out last year. We have Google Gemini. That's a joke. This is a nascent industry. Perhaps it's going to be phenomenal. Although I think the effects on the labor market that have been predicted are wildly overstated. But either way, now we have AI. Are you kidding me? This is socialist utopian nonsense. It's not the role of Congress. And if it were the role of Congress, it should be telling the public that we've got too much in our economy that discourages people from working, not too little. So I hate this. I oppose it. The good news is it's not going to happen. There may be a few firms that try this, although like all fads, whether they keep to it will be an open question. People do seem to be returning to offices. The unlimited vacation days fad seems to be over as well. But to try and impose this nationally, it's not gonna happen. I think there are just enough sensible people and ambitious people in America, and there are enough people who fit that description, even in Congress, to make this a dead letter and a rallying cry for the usual suspects.
Yeah, MBD, the idea this is going to make people happier, but we've talked a lot on the podcast about David Bonson's book. We were at an event. You interviewed David, his book called Full Time. And work is essential to human happiness. I mean, people are depressed when they're not working. And, work can be difficult. It can be a pain, especially when you don't have jobs as rewarding as we're blessed to have, when you're really going and doing something you don't want to do, but it's still an essential part of the human condition. And the Sanders assumption is just that it's not. It's like this capitalist imposition. And to the extent we can limit it, we're going to liberate people and make them happier.
Yeah, I mean, it's this fool. It really is rooted in, I believe this is fully rooted in Marx, in Marx's vision of a future where you spend just a few hours in the morning working and then the rest of the afternoon is hunting and writing poetry, right? Being a dilettante at everything else in life for the majority of your time, rather than being useful and expert most of the time. And it's ridiculous. I mean, it just doesn't work this way, right? I mean, you can even offer things like this to people. You could offer, I mentioned a few weeks ago a book that my friend Adele Waldman wrote, a novel set in a megastore like Target, where the employees are part of this morning crew that unloads the truck. And the basic theme of the thing that unites all the workers in that novel is that they're all desperate to get more hours to work. Like, mm-hmm. They can't get on the schedule enough to get ahead in life. And that actually is a huge problem. For a lot of lower wage workers, is they need more hours. For skilled workers, you do get sometimes these offers of, work fewer hours, you know, I was thinking about this proposal, you know, work fewer hours and get the same pay. I have a brother-in-law who does exactly that, but he does that because he's working the midnight shift at a factory, right? So he's working, was offered, you know, here's 32 hours a week or whatever it is, but you're working 12-hour shifts overnight, and, you know, with all the costs to your health that necessarily imposes by, you know, messing with your circadian rhythm, you know, that's a sacrifice people are willing to, another trade-off made in a market. And, you know, just trying to pronounce on this by fiat across all industries or across all professions makes no sense. People will continue working full time. I mean, people fill their days, right? And in many professions now, the fluidity that the internet and other technologies have brought to work that allow work from home, remote work or whatever, all they've done is allow people to kind of work more, like, and a lot of people do work more or work at odder hours. So I just think it's I don't know. I think Bernie Sanders is the only thing that's kind of charming about it is that it's so retro and 20th century. But it seems totally irrelevant to the future.
Maddie.
Yeah. I mean, I think in trying to justify it, he cited this trial by 60 or so companies in Britain from 2022. And most of these companies had gone down to a 4-day work week. And because, of course, the pandemic sort of changed some of these dynamics anyway. But and those companies had found that actually their revenues and productivity had remained the same. And there were some benefits for their employees. But okay, you can take a study like that and you can say, okay, that worked well for that company. And fair enough, like, good for them. They should do that if that works well for them. But there's no statistical evidence to suggest that this would work nationwide. And certainly across industries. And every company is going to be different. So I agree that, like, while this might be a desirable thing, and certainly it's deepened human motivation to want to do less for more. And that's actually, you know, we mentioned this in our editorial, like that has been the incentive behind a lot of technological breakthroughs, you know, to think that women had to spend hours doing laundry by hand and now they have a washing machine, or there's countless examples like that in agriculture as well. So absolutely, that might be a worthwhile aim, but you can't just make a blanket rule. And the government really just makes a lot of these things worse and introduces perverse incentives. We don't really need more incentives for people to kind of not work. I think there's already quite a lot of those. This is obviously not a good idea. I will say, though, that I think that certainly coming to the US from the UK, I do think that the American work ethic can sometimes be too much. I kind of subscribe to the philosophy articulated by Joseph Piper in Leisure, the Basis of Culture, where he says that work is not the central activity and purpose of our lives. In fact, what is the activities that are done for their own sake. But of course, it is important to be working hard, and it's deep in our sense of dignity to do jobs, and however humble they are, to do them well. But I'm all for, like, finding more time for leisure, finding more time for family and culture. But this is definitely not the way to do it.
So that's a great segue to the exit question. No one wants to talk themselves out of a job, but I'll go to you first, MBD. If someone came to you and said, you don't have to work another day in your life and you'll be financially, you know, everything will be taken care of, comfortable, et cetera, would you take that deal? Yes or no?
So, but I would have to be forbidden. The thing is, like, you'd have to forbid me from working, right? Because I would just wake up one day and just start writing again, you know, like, mm-hmm. So I can't take the deal, Like,
but you would want to write whether you're doing it for pay for someone else or not.
Well, that's the thing is like, if basically you're saying like you would restrict me from doing anything that like I've done so far in life, that's like work, I would have to decline it. Right.
Because yeah. I was wondering, are those the parameters? Are we restricted? Because if you came to me tomorrow, Rich, and this is a hilarious idea, of course, given National Review's position, but if you came to me tomorrow and said, Charles, we want to keep paying you your salary, but you don't have to work, I would say, thank you very much. And then I would take that money and then I would go and get another job. Mm-hmm. And I would add the two together. Mm-hmm. And then I would buy more wine. I mean, so is the idea here that you literally cannot work?
You can't have a job.
You can't have a job. You can't freelance work either.
Rich, yeah, the way you guys are flipping around, because it goes to how we think about work among ourselves. That I said you don't have to work, and you guys are like, so I can't get you're restricting me from having a job, right? Go ahead, Maddie. What were you gonna say?
I was just gonna say I think it's difficult because like we don't really have representative jobs. I was going to say we don't have real jobs. That's not fair. Yeah, but you know, like I think like we
it's vocations and passion.
Yeah, you know. And we love to write and we love to share. Yeah, yeah. Ideas and be in that world. Yeah,
it's not a fair test.
Yeah. So, but if we were, I don't know, doing something that we didn't enjoy, but we certainly saw there was great purpose in it. Let's say we're like, I don't know, I'm not that people in finance don't enjoy their work, but you know, I wouldn't enjoy that personally. Me. That's not to say other people wouldn't. Or like, you know, in marketing or something. And if you said that, I think I'd probably say, yeah, I'll take the deal, but then I'll write a novel. So to your point, it's not that I would be sort of resting on my laurels, not doing anything.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that we are obviously privileged in the jobs we have and shouldn't forget that. But I am talking more generally. If you said to me, you can't have a job in this industry, you can't write a novel, you can't write anymore, you can't argue about politics on podcast, I would start a business or go work in a pizza restaurant or something. I just could not sit around all day. I can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this goes to Maddie's point, though. Like, what's the definition of sitting around all day? So I look in my office here. It doesn't have much adornment, but I have these old paintings my mom did of this adorable cat we used to have, and she's done them in Japanese style, and it just captures the silhouette of this beautiful creature. Had wonderful lines. This black cat, and she did that for herself. But it's like the value of it like accrues over time, and it was a passion. And she worked at it hard. So is that sitting around? You know, if she wasn't at the local pizza restaurant slinging pies, instead she was working at that. Where does that fall in your that's matrix?
That's leisure and culture, and that's completely worthwhile.
It's great, but it's not a job.
Well, no, but not everybody can do that. Otherwise, the economy would grind.
No, but the thing is I think about this too, because I wouldn't sit all day in my house. I would, if I were literally forbidden from working, I would go and do things. But I think that I would be immensely frustrated that I was forbidden from turning those things into a means by which to make money or grow something.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the difference. I'm not good at painting, so I wouldn't do that. But I'm a very good musician. I could sit and I could make music a lot. I would do that. But if I were prohibited from saying, you know what, this one's quite good, I'll put it on Spotify and see what happens, I'd go crazy. It's yeah, not just about sit,
do it for yourself.
Well, because I'd want other people to see it, and I think a lot of people who are very successful in arts, which is what we're now talking about, they feel that too. That they start to get ambitious and they want to play in front of people, and maybe it starts with 10 people, then it becomes 300, and then someone says, well, you should record it, and then maybe you stream it over the internet, and then that would be infuriating to me.
Yeah, I once had a conversation with George Gilder. I don't know what we're talking about, inequality or greed or something. And he's like, you know, the thing about entrepreneurs is it just what you said, Charlie, about, you know, wanting to start something and grow something made me think of this. Is they don't like take their money and fritter it away. You know, they might buy a lot of houses and have a comfortable lifestyle, but fundamentally, what they do, they all like plow it right back into the business, right? Because they want to grow it and make it bigger, and there's something, you know, fundamentally human about that.
Or they do something else. Look at Elon Musk.
Right.
So Musk was instrumental with Peter Thiel in PayPal. Then he does Tesla. and SpaceX. And I'm reading the newspaper yesterday, and he's got this Neuralink device that he's implanting in people's brains that allow disabled people to play chess and use computers just by thinking. Again, he's very rich. He's got private jets. He has lots of things I would like to have. But he's actually not just sitting around. As you say, he's like, what can I do next? Oh, I'll reinvent the human brain.
Yeah. I've always been big on brain chips, like that being the next, you know, that one day you won't need the iPhone. You'll just think, you know, what's the Padre score today? And it'll flash, you know, it'll occur to you what it is. I think it was 15 to 10 today. Not that I'm a Padres fan. So, all right, MBD, let's hit a few other things before we go. This is definitely leisure activity. You've been watching the series, The Gentleman.
I just started this week. I think it just came out this week. It's produced by Guy Ritchie, and it's a kind of spinoff of his 2019 movie, The Gentleman, which was really fun. I'm a huge sucker for Guy Ritchie's kind of English gangster genre, which I just find ridiculous. I have to say, I enjoy it for the most, puerile reasons, right? Like, I enjoy watching English people engage in their parochial racism against Liverpudlians and
Liverpudlians aren't people, so.
Well, I mean, the way that they talk about Scouse, you know, coke dealers or whatever, I don't know. It's just very, it's like an entry into this incredible world of vice that is normally forbidden from me, but is also obscure and hobbit-like in its way. So, I recommend it highly.
So, Maddie, you had a family visit?
Yes, so my mom arrived yesterday and my dad is arriving later today and they're staying with us until Easter. And we have some fun things planned, including a Broadway show. So I'm really looking forward to it.
And Charlie, you guys have an old school baseball board game.
It's called Real Action Baseball and it's the most low-tech thing we have in our house. My house is a bit of a cornucopia of technologically advanced stuff. My kids love that. But this game is just so addictive because it's not. It's a large diamond-shaped plastic board. It works with ball bearings and springs, basically. You pitch by pulling back a spring and letting go. And that's also how you bat. And
it's a little bit like a pinball machine or sort of pinball.
Yeah, a little bit like that. It's sort of baseball pinball, except it does resemble a game pretty well. And then where you hit it on the field determines whether it's a single, double, or a triple, or you're out. Out is the most common result. And then you move these physical players to first or second base, depending, and then you count up the score yourself. And when I first saw it, I thought, well, I don't know why my son wanted that, but okay, it was his birthday. But now I understand. We played it last night for hours. And when the kids went to bed, I almost said to my wife, hey, do you want to play live action baseball? But she wanted to watch a movie instead.
So I'm an embarrassed alum of the University of Virginia. Its basketball program was scuffling towards the end of the season, but they play at a big-time conference, the ACC. I think they finished third in the regular season. So they got a first four bid into the tournament and totally just embarrassed themselves. The offense has been terrible almost all season long. They scored 14 points in the first half, 14 points, which has to be one of the worst performances ever in an NCAA tournament game. I guess Tony Bennett deserves congratulations for getting this far with a team that just literally could not shoot at all. They couldn't even make free throws. There was one game a couple weeks ago, they were 1 for 11. From the line, but it was not a great look for dear old UVA. So MBD, is time for our editor's picks. What's your pick?
My pick is yours on the shameful success of Letitia James. Just cannot get over how consequential this case may be this year, how flimsy it is. I mean, torts are supposed to deal with actual harms, and I don't see the harm Trump committed here to anyone. And she's the one who's made herself the star of the prosecuting team.
Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick is our editorial on Bernie Sanders' proposal. I don't know if I'm allowed to say who wrote it, but I just thought it was very well
done. Not.
We all wrote it. It was very well done.
We're all broadly responsible for it. Charlie, what's your pick?
I'm just going to pick a short corner post by Michael called Confessing My Unbelief, in which Michael confirms that he does not entirely believe that there is this massive, hugely consequential swing of Hispanic and Black voters away from Biden and toward Trump. I agree with Michael, or at least I will believe it when I see it. I'm generally skeptical, as you know. I think we're probably at about 50-50 at the moment in terms of Biden winning the election or Trump winning the election. But I wouldn't be surprised if...
That's a change from Tuesday, isn't it? What's it, 48-52?
Yeah, I am 48-52 because I think Biden's slightly a favorite, but I'm around that middle point. But I could absolutely see it going back down. I think I sort of expect to. I've written over and over, Biden's still the favorite. And this is one reason. I'm just not convinced, like Michael. So Michael said on Twitter, was it this morning, that you weren't sure if you were the only person in America who didn't believe the polls. Well, you're not, because I'm with you. Okay, good.
So my pick is a piece that Maddie wrote about this new movie, Cabrini, titled Cabrini Fails on Purpose. I'm not always a fan of Maddie's film criticism, but she engaged in a very compelling way with this movie from Angel Studios. They're wonderful people, but Maddie points out a flaw in the movie, and you can read it yourself to find out. So that's it for us. You've been listening to an National U podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or count this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Fast Growing Trees. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.